In Los Angeles, a band of gunmen invade an armored car company. They grab millions and then vanish. When the FBI does find suspects, insufficient evidence prevents their arrest. Agents and detectives try to penetrate the gunman's secretive world to bring them to justice.
Robbery is a terrifying ordeal. When a gang descended on a Los Angeles cash vault, they threatened to kill anyone who resisted. The violent assault was the largest heist in U.S. history, and a piece of plastic was the only evidence. I'm Jim Kallstrom, former head of the FBI's New York office. The FBI, LAPD, and the IRS joined forces to unravel a complex network of money laundering, fraud, and a tight code of silence.
The Los Angeles warehouse district is a tough, bleak part of town. Street gangs and violence are common. The area's businesses are housed in nondescript buildings, many surrounded by barbed wire fences. One secure block was occupied by a leading armored car company. Friday night, September 13th, 1997. Employees of the armored car company were going about their routine, counting and sorting over $20 million. The money would be dispersed to automated teller machines across Los Angeles to meet the weekend demand for cash. There were five employees, including two security guards, working the graveyard shift. At 12:30 a.m., one guard took his break in the lunchroom as he did every night. But he wasn't alone. Five armed men subdued the guard in seconds. They dragged their hostage into an office where security monitors were kept. Then a second security guard, preparing to go home for the night, entered. Unarmed and out of uniform, he offered no resistance. Four of the assailants headed for the cash vault. The fifth held the guards at gunpoint and monitored the security cameras. The employees in the vault prep area were unaware that the building was under siege. The gunman threatened to shoot if anyone disobeyed orders or made any sudden moves. The thieves now had direct access to the vault and its $20 million.
Put your head down. Get that head down. Number three, stay on the orders, too.
One man appeared to be in charge, barking orders to his accomplices.
No, don't touch that. This bin over here, this one right here. Number five, everything's on schedule.
He also used a concealed radio headset to direct others somewhere outside the vault. When commanding his men, the leader didn't use names, only a numbered code. The robbers were coldly efficient, wasting no movement. In less than 10 minutes, they wheeled millions to the loading dock.
No, this one right here.
In the outer office, the gunman removed the surveillance recorder bolted to a desk. Seconds later, employees heard more destruction in the back office. When the leader and another man returned, the employees no doubt feared it was to eliminate witnesses. But the assailants only stole the vault manager's pickup truck keys. Suddenly, it was quiet. Believing the gunman had fled, the guards risked freeing themselves.
Hold on, Charles. I'll help you out in a minute.
They called 911. LAPD officers were immediately dispatched to the scene.
Okay, hold on. We're going to go down there right now.
Detective John Licata knew the case was unusual from the beginning.
We have experienced armored car robberies where the couriers or the truck are attacked.
Licata, robbery, homicide.
But this was the first time we've ever had a facility hit.
Officers secured the crime scene, and detectives began interviewing the employees. They said the five assailants seemed to move through the facility as if they had been there before. They didn't see them leave, but they heard the sound of a diesel engine pulling into, then out of the loading area. A sixth assailant must have been driving. One employee thought she recognized the voice of one of the gunmen as that of a former armored car driver for the company. She agreed to come to the station in the morning to study a photo lineup of former employees.
What's your name, sir?
Detectives spoke with the vault manager whose personal pickup truck and keys had been stolen. They wondered why his keys were taken and not the others. The manager said he parked in the same spot each night.
None of the suspects had asked him what the vehicle looked like. That led us to believe that whoever took his keys and had taken his vehicle knew him and his vehicle.
The manager agreed one of the men's voices was familiar, but he couldn't think of a name. He said he would contact them if it came to him. Forensic technicians took impressions of the facility's door locks. Initially, damage found on the doors and locks suggested the thieves used force to gain entry. But later examination by technicians in the police lab proved otherwise.
There was damage to the locks and the mechanisms, but not to the degree that it would have caused them to malfunction and to open.
They believed the gunman had used a key, then faked signs of forced entry. Company officials later estimated the loss at a staggering $18.9 million. The robbers knew what to take and what to leave behind.
All of the high cash bins, those bins that contained large amounts of cash, were taken. Those that didn't, that contained stamps and cash checks, were not taken.
This suggested that the assailants knew how the company stored its cash. The robbers also appeared to know where the company had installed its video surveillance recorders, including a backup machine that was hidden inside a locked cabinet in the back office. Employees had heard the assailants destroy the lock to get to the backup VCR.
And the recording devices were kept in a cabinet, inaccessible to most employees. We interviewed all the facility employees, and 80% of them didn't know about the recording devices in the back office.
Investigators processed the loading area for any evidence of shoe prints, tire tracks, or clothing fibers. They found none. But they did discover what appeared to be a broken truck reflector or lens cover.
I personally spoke with the maintenance person that had cleaned the facility earlier in the day, and he assured me that that lens would have had to have been left there sometime in the evening. So it was surmised by us that it probably was left by the suspect's vehicle. We didn't have a lot of clues as to what the vehicle would be other than that reflector that was recovered, and we didn't know if it was a common item taken off of trucks or vehicles.
Since the money stolen from the facility was federally insured, the FBI joined the investigation. Special Agent John McCarran from the Los Angeles field office studied a crime scene video made by the Los Angeles police that detailed the sequence of the gunman's activities during the robbery.
And put him in this room here. This door is unlocked. They laid both victims down on the floor here, and they also removed their keys. Once they did that,
the five masked gunmen had pulled off the largest cash heist in U.S. history. Agent McCarran hoped the public could help find them.
The media was given general descriptions of the individuals that committed the robbery as far as height and weight and clothing and the fact that the individuals were all armed, and there was a posting of a reward at the time.
Assistant U.S. Attorney Alka Sager hoped the vague descriptions would be enough to produce a lead.
The victims told us that they believed that the robbers were black, and that was based on the skin color that they saw through the eye holes of the mask. And they also told us that one of the robbers appeared to be lighter skinned, and he may be Hispanic. They were not able to see anybody's face.
But they had heard voices. At LAPD headquarters, one of the armored car company employees was shown a photo lineup. The woman believed she had recognized the voice of one of the robbers. Now she was trying to match his voice to a face. The lineup consisted of pictures of policemen mixed with several former armored car drivers and security officers. She picked one former driver as a possible match to the voice she heard on the night of the robbery.
Yes.
Police learned that the man had recently left L.A. for New Orleans. Agents from the FBI's New Orleans field office approached the former armored car driver at his family's home there.
I'm
Major Marks from the FBI is my partner.
He said he was unaware that the company had been robbed and was willing to cooperate.
So why not? Come on in.
Sure. Sit down over here.
He said that he had left his job on good terms a few weeks before the robbery.
It turned out that he was out of town on vacation during the robbery, and the agents were able to corroborate his statements about being out of town.
Thank you very much.
On the night of the robbery in Los Angeles, the man was 1,900 miles away in Louisiana.
Gentlemen, have a nice day. Thanks a lot.
So he was ruled out as a suspect.
Despite the false lead, investigators still believed the robbery had been an inside job. But whoever the gunmen were, they left little behind. And with $18.9 million in their hands, they could be anywhere. In September 1997, the FBI and the LAPD were unable to identify any of the six masked men who had robbed an armored car company of nearly $19 million. They believed at least one was a current or former employee, since the gang entered the building with a key and knew where hidden surveillance equipment was.
You made mention at the scene.
In a second interview, the vault manager on duty during the heist realized he recognized the voice of the lead gunman.
Plus, he just got let go, too, so maybe...
He believed the man was Alan Pace, a former company employee. He thought Pace was one of the two gunmen who stole the keys to his pickup truck. Pace was familiar with the truck and had asked to borrow it before.
He would be the one to know what type of truck I drive.
FBI Special Agent John McCarran studied Pace's employment history.
Alan Pace was an employee who had worked for the company for approximately a year and a half. He was actually suspended the day prior to the robbery.
28-year-old Alan Pace had no criminal record, but when the company suspended him for disciplinary reasons, he had not turned in his keys. Investigators went to interview Pace at his home in Los Angeles.
Pace
told them he knew about the robbery through the media, but assured the agents that he had nothing to do with the heist. He said he was at a party with his girlfriend on the night of the crime. He gave them her address and phone number. Investigators needed to verify Pace's alibi. They called in for a background check on the girlfriend. Detective John Licata learned she was a former employee, too.
Mr. Pace's girlfriend worked in the facility in the cash vault area and specifically had a position that required her to handle the security video equipment. She had been terminated approximately 4 weeks prior to the robbery.
Investigators asked Pace's girlfriend about the night of the robbery. She confirmed that on that night, Pace and several of his friends attended an all-night party in Long Beach. She and Pace stayed at the party through the early morning hours of the following day. And there were plenty of witnesses who saw them there. Though suspicious, Pace's alibi was corroborated, and it was enough to block investigators temporarily. They would need a different tack to keep the case moving forward.
Yeah, John Licata here. How you doing?
The only physical evidence was a cracked amber lens found at the crime scene.
We're going to take
they believed it came from a diesel truck used as one of the getaway vehicles. They needed to find that truck.
I got the assistance of some of my partners and half a dozen of us for the next 5 evenings between the hours of 11 p.m. and 3 a.m. Went to the location of where the armored car facility was and interviewed anyone that frequented the area either on foot or in a vehicle.
A week after the robbery, they patrolled the warehouse district near the scene of the crime. After several nights, they found a homeless man who lived on the streets in the area.
What's your name?
Henry,
is this where you stay?
He said that on the night the robbery took place, he saw a mid-sized rental truck idling near the armored car company.
What kind of truck?
It sounded like a diesel.
Big white truck?
He noticed it that night because usually there was little business or late-night traffic in the area. But he didn't see the driver. He had never seen the truck there before or since.
Take care of yourself, Henry.
All right, sir.
The description of the diesel rental truck fit the victim's statements that they heard a diesel truck in the company loading area. Investigators suspected that the amber lens found in the loading area had fallen off that truck. Teams of agents and detectives canvassed facilities in the Los Angeles area that rented diesel trucks. They showed employees a photo of the partial lens found at the crime scene. Several recognized the lens as the type used on the running lights for a certain model of truck. The lenses were a problem because they frequently fell off and needed to be replaced.
There were 83 rental truck facilities that rented the truck that the lens most likely came off of. We subpoenaed documents from all the rental vehicles that they had rented 2 months prior to the robbery for a period of time 2 months after the robbery.
Investigators spent hours poring through the rental records. But there were no rentals by Alan Pace or his girlfriend. It looked like another dead end. Authorities contacted Assistant U.S. Attorney Alka Sager for legal advice on how to proceed.
You can't just go get a warrant because somebody's a suspect and you think that they did a crime. You have to have evidence that they committed the crime. Alan Pace had denied any involvement in the robbery and had even claimed that he was at another place. He had an alibi, which witnesses that we spoke to corroborated. So at that point in time, all we had was the fact that he was a disgruntled employee who had been fired the day before the robbery, and one of the employees believed that one of the robbers had a voice that was similar to his. And that clearly was not enough evidence.
To find out more, the FBI and LAPD began watching the former armored car company employee. If Pace was involved in the multi-million dollar robbery, he might show signs of his newfound wealth.
We did do surveillance of Mr. Pace, and he did not appear to be living beyond his means. He didn't appear to be spending a lot of money. He didn't appear to have a lot of cash at his disposal.
Nothing implicated Pace in the robbery beyond the circumstantial evidence they already had. As the months passed, there was little movement on the case. The reward for information leading to a conviction now totaled $250,000.
Despite the extensive media publicity this case received, and the rewards for any information about the perpetrators of this robbery, there were absolutely no leads, no forensic evidence, no eyewitnesses. The investigation just came to a grinding halt.
Though Pace was still the primary suspect, without more substantial evidence, the FBI was unable to make an arrest. For now, it appeared that Alan Pace and five accomplices had gotten away with nearly $19 million in cash. By September of 1998, a full year had passed since six masked gunmen made off with almost $19 million. The prime suspect was Alan Pace, a former armored car company employee, suspended the day before the crime. Assistant U.S. Attorney Alka Sager was frustrated by the lack of evidence against Pace.
It didn't appear that he was out there spending money. It didn't appear that he had the fruits of the crime. So there really wasn't any legal basis to go out and arrest him or even to search his house.
Then, press coverage of the one-year anniversary of the crime prompted a lead for case agent John McCarran. An informant called the FBI, saying he thought he might know one of the robbers. Investigators went to the informant's home in suburban Los Angeles. The informant explained he had been an employee of the armored car company a year earlier, around the time of the robbery. He had since left to become a real estate agent. He claimed that shortly after the robbery, he was given $100,000 in cash to purchase a home for a man he knew, Eugene Hill. Hill asked that the deed to the home be listed in the name of his girlfriend. At his girlfriend's apartment, Hill stored a trunk filled with smaller boxes. He gave one of the boxes to the informant. It contained cash, still bundled by bank wrappers, totaling $100,000.
The informant, when he received the money, noticed that the $10,000 bundles had these bank straps on them. He kept those bank straps.
They were dated the 2 days prior to the heist.
We were able to later determine the paper type wrappers actually came from some of the money stolen from the armored car company.
The informant said Hill changed his mind and asked for the money back, but in cashier's checks, not cash. The informant had kept $15,000, and Hill had recently begun threatening him. He hoped the FBI could protect him. Eugene Hill had no criminal record and had never worked at the armored car company. But a background check revealed Hill had a connection with prime suspect Alan Pace. Both had worked for another security agency in Los Angeles. Investigators began surveillance on Hill. At one point, they followed him to a business named Extreme Entertainment. The company billed itself as an entertainment service that provided everything from children's games to exotic dancers. Business records revealed that Eugene Hill was a partner in the company, along with Alan Pace. Investigators suspected that Extreme Entertainment was likely established to launder money from the robbery.
The Internal Revenue Service was brought on board and supplied with information from records and documents which would assist us in preparing money laundering charges against some of these individuals.
The investigative team learned more about the company. Besides Alan Pace and Eugene Hill, Extreme Entertainment listed two other men as partners, Terry Brown and Fred McCrary. The four had worked together at the same L.A. security agency before Alan Pace was hired at the armored car company. Extreme Entertainment's accounting books looked suspicious to Los Angeles IRS assistant special agent in charge, Philip Mullins.
There were four suspected robbers involved in Extreme Entertainment. Extreme Entertainment wasn't really generating very much income, but there was a lot of cash going through the business, into the bank accounts, and then a lot of money being paid out in salaries.
Investigators began to dig deeper into the financial backgrounds of the four partners. They subpoenaed bank statements, credit card reports, and tax returns. In the personal bank records of Eugene Hill, they found the suspect had a second source of income.
One of the things that we discovered were deposits of checks from a company called Rainforest. Now, we'd never heard of Rainforest, and we didn't know what kind of company it was, so we went and looked at the Rainforest bank records. And we found that in addition to writing regular monthly checks to Eugene Hill, Rainforest was also writing checks on a regular basis to somebody named Thomas Johnson.
Like Hill, Thomas Johnson's position at Rainforest was listed as a consultant. It was unclear what type of consultants they were. Rainforest was in business developing new recycling technologies. Johnson and Hill had invested $2 million in the company. The investment in a legitimate company was a classic money laundering scheme.
You take bad money, you invest it in something, you hide it, conceal it, and ultimately end up with something that looks legitimate.
Investigators felt confident that the five men were strong suspects, but so far, no evidence connected them directly to the $18.9 million robbery. LAPD Detective John LaCava and his partner, Detective John Wong, cross-referenced the suspects' names against truck rental records from the time of the robbery.
Sure, that'd be fine.
Detective Wong made an important discovery.
My partner, John Wong, is the one that found the rental agreement from one of the suspects, Eugene Hill, in which he had rented the suspect's vehicle that was used that night just prior to the robbery and then returned just after the robbery.
We were able to locate that very truck. It was still in the Los Angeles area. And we got that truck and we removed the light assembly and had the FBI forensics lab compare it to the lens that was found on the loading dock area.
They needed to know if the amber lens had fallen off that truck. While waiting for the lab results, investigators looked further into suspect Thomas Johnson. Johnson lived in an expensive home in an upscale Las Vegas neighborhood.
The IRS conducted surveillance of his residence, and during that period of time, his girlfriend at the time was identified.
Agents flagged the girlfriend's name. If Vegas police ran into her, they should call L.A. On the night of September 10th, 1999, nearly 2 years to the day after the robbery, the team in L.A. got a call and boarded a helicopter. There had been a domestic disturbance at Thomas Johnson's Las Vegas home. Johnson's girlfriend had called the police. They hoped to use the disturbance call as an opportunity to question the girlfriend. She alleged that Johnson had beaten her. She was more than willing to answer any questions they had about him. She said Johnson was laundering money through the Las Vegas casinos. He and a friend would buy thousands of dollars in chips that he would later have her exchange for cash. The exchange was always in amounts less than $10,000 to avoid filling out cash reports.
Thomas Johnson appeared to be very fond of gambling and appeared to have a lot of money with which to gamble. And it's a little tricky when you do these types of investigations because you don't know where that money is coming from, if it's perhaps gambling winnings that are then being used to conduct more gambling activities, or if it's perhaps what we thought, which was money from the robbery.
The girlfriend told investigators Johnson had mentioned a big job that he had taken part in back in Los Angeles. She said Johnson had invested in a company with a gambling friend. When investigators showed her a photo of Eugene Hill, she confirmed that he was Johnson's friend. The The circumstantial evidence against Thomas Johnson, Alan Pace, and Eugene Hill was building. But it was still not enough to make any arrests. Agents would need to turn the suspects against one another if there was to be any hope of convictions. Two years after six masked gunmen robbed an armored car company of $18.9 million, the FBI, IRS, and LAPD had gathered strong circumstantial evidence against five suspects, but had nothing that directly tied the men to the crime. The only physical evidence recovered was a cracked amber lens found in the loading area of the armored car company. Investigators believe the lens fell off a truck rented by suspect Eugene Hill the day before the robbery. They sent the broken lens and the other lenses from the truck's running lights to the FBI lab in Washington, D.C. Forensic metallurgist Michael Smith compared tool marks from the broken lens to those on the other lenses from the truck.
In this case, the marks look rather like the rings on a tree, and we attempt to see whether those marks line up or not.
Using a high-powered comparison microscope, he made an exact match. The same tool had made all the lenses in the same work session, indicating the broken lens had very likely come from the truck rented by Hill. The forensics results were compelling, but they did not definitively prove that Eugene Hill or the other four suspects were with the truck during the robbery. Assistant U.S. Attorney Alka Sager needed stronger evidence before authorizing arrests. She hoped Hill's girlfriends would provide it.
We had identified two of his girlfriends who also appeared to be spending not large amounts, but amounts of cash. Approximately 2 years after the robbery, we had gotten to the point where we needed to talk to these women that were in Eugene Hill's life. We're going to need your
cooperation. Worried that charges might be filed against her, one of Hill's girlfriends rolled, telling investigators what she knew. She told them that after the date of the robbery, Hill suddenly had a lot of cash. She said Hill stored two footlockers filled with boxes of the cash in her apartment. She and a friend helped him count and sort thousands. Hill told her that before the new crisp bills could be spent, they needed to look worn. So she washed them. Usually, Thomas Johnson took part in the operation. She said they would go to Las Vegas, buy gambling chips with the washed bills, and then turn them in for new cash. Her story corroborated the statement previously given by Johnson's girlfriend. In return for her testimony, prosecutors agreed not to file charges against her. Next, FBI agents and LAPD detectives wanted to talk to Eugene Hill's sister. They had some questions about bank accounts the IRS had uncovered.
We were able to subpoena her records and determine that she had several accounts that she was holding in trust for Eugene Hill. Those records showed that there were a lot of unexplained cash deposits into those records, and it also appeared that checks were being written for motorcycles and vehicles and other consumer goods. So now we had a little bit more indication that Eugene Hill was perhaps spending money that he really couldn't explain receiving.
She agreed to talk to the investigators, but said she first needed to make a phone call. She stepped away and appeared to send a numeric page. Investigators asked her about the accounts she held for her brother. She was evasive and claimed to be unaware of any of her brother's financial matters. Moments after the phone call, Eugene Hill arrived. When questioned, Hill denied any knowledge of the armored car company robbery. He told investigators that he didn't have time to answer their questions then, but he would meet them the next morning at their office. Loaded with cash, Hill was a significant flight risk. The FBI called Assistant U.S. Attorney Alka Sager for advice.
I was just getting ready for bed. The phone rang at home, and the agent said, this is what Mr. Hill wants to do. Should we let him go? And it was just one of those split-second, decisions that had to be made. And I made the decision that we were not going to let Eugene Hill go. We were going to arrest him that night.
As Hill was heading back to his car, he was placed under arrest. With only circumstantial evidence connecting him to the robbery, it was a risk. The law requires an expeditious trial, and the clock had begun to tick. On September 23rd, 1999, FBI arrested Eugene Hill, one of five men suspected in an armored car company heist. Assistant U.S. Attorney Alka Sager had made the decision to arrest Hill, despite having only circumstantial evidence linking him to the crime.
By letting Hill go, there was a real danger that he would have alerted the others to the investigation. Given the amount of money that was taken in this robbery, it was apparent that these robbers would have the means to flee if they wanted to. And I just felt we couldn't take that chance.
A search of Hill's home provided no solid evidence tying Hill to the robbery. But investigators did discover ledgers that showed Hill had purchased real estate in other people's names. Prime suspect Alan Pace was also listed on Hill's ledgers as having purchased real estate in others' names. Finally, IRS agent Philip Mullins had something on Pace.
This was very significant in that there was over $1 million worth of real estate purchased for Alan Pace, that he had no legitimate source of income to purchase that property.
If convicted, Eugene Hill was facing up to 40 years in prison. Hoping for sentencing consideration, he confessed and promised to tell police everything he knew.
All right, who's this Alan Pace?
He said Alan Pace recruited him and three others for the robbery.
Alan Pace told him that he had already spoken to Terry Brown and Freddie McCrary, and they were ready to do the job. And he wanted Eugene Hill to come on board and maybe bring another person in. So Eugene Hill approached Thomas Johnson, who agreed to participate, and that's where the plan was hatched.
Hill confirmed Pace was the mastermind of the heist and leader of the gang. Hill knew all of the men except for the sixth, who was a personal friend of Pace's. Pace told the others his plan could set them up for life.
Five to six employees at most.
Alan Pace told them that they would do the robbery on Friday night when there would be very few employees working there. He said that he knew who those employees were, that they wouldn't offer any resistance, and that it wouldn't be a problem. They would just tie up the employees, take the money, and they'd be in and out, within half an hour.
Following orders, Hill rented the diesel truck on the day of the robbery and met up with the gang at the party in Long Beach. Shortly before midnight, they left the party one by one. They drove to the warehouse district, then five walked to the armored car company. During the robbery, one man stayed with the truck, waiting a few blocks away for the call to pull in. When the truck arrived, they loaded it up. Pace knew to take the surveillance equipment. They later transferred the money to a storage unit rented by Thomas Johnson, where it remained for 2 weeks. 4 of them left in the rental truck. Eugene Hill and Alan Pace drove away in the vault manager's pickup, since Pace knew where he parked each night. The 6 men disposed of the guns and VCRs, changed their clothes, and returned to the party as if nothing had happened. In the time it took others at the party to drink a couple more beers, the gang had committed the largest armed robbery in U.S. history. Investigators needed to corroborate Eugene Hill's story. FBI Special Agent John McCarran and his team believed Thomas Johnson should be the next one taken.
Agents in our Las Vegas field office were conducting surveillance on Thomas Johnson, and we knew his exact location. We followed him from one of the casinos.
Agents tailed Johnson as he visited several casinos. They did not know if the suspect was armed. To execute a safe arrest, agents needed to isolate Johnson outside and away from the casino crowd. They asked a casino security guard to approach him with a ruse. The guard told Johnson his car had been hit and that he needed to go outside to fill out a report. Johnson took the bait. As he checked his car, agents safely took him into custody. Investigators laid out the case against him and the possibility of decades in prison. Like Eugene Hill, Johnson cooperated in the hopes of a lighter sentence. Johnson verified Hill's version of the robbery and confirmed that Alan Pace was the leader. Investigators finally had sufficient evidence. They quickly arrested everyone but the leader.
We knew that Pace was aware of the earlier arrests of the other individuals. There was a warrant for his arrest, and he contacted me here at my office and told me that he wanted to self-surrender.
On February 28th, 2000, Pace arrived at the L.A. Federal Building in the company of his lawyer. He made no statement and refused to cooperate with investigators. Pace was arrested and held without bail. 4 of the robbers pled guilty to robbery and conspiracy. Eugene Hill was sentenced to 9 years in prison. Thomas Johnson received 10 years. Fred McCrary received 7.5 years, and Terry Brown got 8. The 6th gunman, Eric Boyd, fought the charges against him and was found guilty and sentenced to 17 years. After a 3-week trial, Alan Pace, who had orchestrated the armed robbery, was sentenced to 24 years in prison. Agents seized all of the criminals' assets. They were able to account for about $5 million of the stolen money.
So about $14 million remains missing. We don't know where that money is, how it was spent, if it was spent. We just have no idea.
But whenever the felons are finally released, the FBI will be watching.
No one drops it down.
If they make any moves to recover hidden money, they'll go straight back to jail.